Adam simmered in the jail cell through the weekend. During this time, Janice and Larry received just one call from him. "I want you to know," he told them, "I got beat up yesterday."
"Well, I'm sorry to hear that,"
Janice responded, trying hard to sound nonchalant. The Browns consulted an attorney and spoke with the Whiteds, arriving at a plea to present to the judge. They agreed to drop the charges if restitution was paid and if Adam would consent to 1 year in Teen Challenge instead of the year in prison he was facing. 5 days in jail seemed to have humbled Adam, thought Pastor Smith on his second visit, and Adam immediately began sharing his spiritual history. Though Adam's attendance at church was sporadic throughout his childhood, at age 14 he had invited the Lord into his heart and been baptized at Center Fork Missionary Baptist Church, where he was taught that God forgave his sins and offered him eternal salvation. At the time, Adam's Sunday school teacher had been Wanda Holden, mother of Richie, the boy with Down syndrome he had stood up for.
"Almost every day at the end of Bible study," says Wanda, "Adam requested we say a prayer for his parents, that they be drawn to the Lord and be saved."
Now Adam said he was ready to recommit his life to Jesus and asked the pastor if he could help. "I've been here before with other people in jail," Pastor Smith said. "They've prayed like we're about to. But Adam, I want you to know that God can and really does want to change your life. But it begins with an honest and open desire from you to say, 'God, it's no more about me. It's about you.' Are you ready for that commitment?"
"I am," said Adam.
And on the other side of the glass partition, he got off the chair, knelt down, bowed his head, and repeated after the pastor,
"God, for the first time in my life, I trust you. And God, I thank you that I'm here in jail. God, whatever you've planned for my life, I trust you. God, I'm sorry for my sins. And today, the best way I know how, I ask you to come into my life. Come into my heart and save me. I want to begin a brand new life. Amen."
Pastor Smith visited Adam again after several days. "Adam had questions," he says, "lots of questions. But the biggest one was, after all I've done, how do I begin to live this Christian life? How do I turn my life around?" "Well, the bad news is you can't," Pastor Smith said to Adam. "But the good news is Christ can turn it around for you, and he'll give you the strength and power to do it."
"How?" Adam asked.
"Let me just show you a verse in the Bible. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. That's Philippians 4:13. If we try to do it within our own power, Adam, we're going to fail." 1 week later, Adam faced the judge, who sentenced him to a total of 45 days in the Garland County Detention Center, after which he would attend the Teen Challenge drug treatment program at an out-of-state location. Teen Challenge, a faith-based nationwide residential program that treats all ages despite the name, was not a lockdown program, the judge explained. Adam could leave any time he wanted, but if he did, he would be back in jail for an additional year. As for the restitution, it was more than $10,000, which Janice and Larry paid once again. After Adam served the entire 45-day sentence, Larry picked his son up from jail. Adam was stoic as they hugged, then walked to the car, but once they began to drive, he broke down and cried. Larry told him they weren't going home, but instead heading to a father-son weekend retreat run by Second Baptist Church. Knowing that Adam, too, had recommitted his life to Jesus, Larry believed the retreat would be a safe environment for reconciliation before Adam left on Monday for Teen Challenge. They arrived at a local lake in time for the hamburger cookout and found 40 10- and 11-year-old boys eating at picnic tables with their 30-something fathers.
"We at the right place, Dad?" Adam asked, and the two began to laugh, the first time in a couple of years.
They laughed again when the boys expressed their delight at having Adam on their team for the fathers versus sons soccer game. The night was spent in a group Bible study, roasting marshmallows around a fire pit and sharing a cabin dormitory. Early the next morning, with cups of coffee in hand, Adam and Larry walked to the edge of the lake and had a heart-to-heart.
Adam apologized for the pain he'd put his parents through in the past 2 years, and Larry apologized for the harsh words he'd spoken to Adam. What haunted Larry most was when he'd called Adam simple-minded and lazy during one heated argument. Adam told him he probably deserved it at the time, but Larry was firm that it had been hurtful, and he'd meant it to be hurtful, and that was wrong. They agreed to leave the past behind them and prayed together. "That's done, Lord," Larry said. "We're going forward from here, and we're putting all of our trust in you." On Sunday, Adam reconnected with his mother, receiving too many hugs to count. Manda, who had graduated from college and was working as an X-ray technician at a local hospital, did the same when she joined them at church. Though happy about Adam's sentencing to rehab, Sean still had his reservations about his brother and chose not to see him. "I was behind him," he explains. "I just wasn't ready to face him." The following day, as Janice and Larry saw Adam off at the airport, she told her son she was proud of him. "For what, Mom?" Adam said. "I just got out of jail."
"Because I know what you're fighting is real hard," she said. "You keep fighting."
Larry sent his son off with Proverbs 3:5-6. "Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct your paths." At the Sanford, Florida Teen Challenge, Adam was one of 100 mostly young men receiving treatment for life-controlling behaviors and addictions. There were no fences around the suburban neighborhood property that looked like a small school with a central basketball court. The doors were not locked in the dormitory-style housing, which consisted of bunk beds, lockers, and a communal bathroom. "When we first got there, it felt like Bible boot camp," says Kenny Marston, a recovering crack addict who roomed with Adam in 1996. "But it was a safe haven, and we needed that." This safe haven at first isolated Adam from any outside pressures. Phone calls were prohibited the initial month, while letter writing was encouraged. No visitors were allowed in the first 4 months. Then family visits were permitted on prearranged weekends for a few hours. And then, with good behavior, 8-hour passes for day excursions were issued. Otherwise, Adam was ensconced in the program. What little free time there was consisted of half-hour to 1-hour blocks that could be used for exercise, working out in the weight room, or playing a pickup game on the basketball court, where Adam usually gravitated. 5 days a week, Adam rose at 5 a.m., ate breakfast, and was driven to the program's auto detailing shop at the Mannheim Auto Auction in Sanford, where he waxed and buffed cars with a heavy commercial buff pad from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. On the ride back to the center, he would get in a quick nap before attending Bible-related classes with titles such as Attitudes, Overcoming Temptation, Growing Through Failure, How to Study the Bible, and Loving and Accepting Myself, followed by one-on-one counseling and chapel. After that, it was a cafeteria-style dinner, quiet time for personal devotions, and lights out at 10 p.m. That first week at Teen Challenge, Adam heard the parable of the prodigal son. The story from the book of Luke would become his favorite, one he returned to repeatedly for inspiration while attending the rehab program. In the parable, Jesus told how a man's son brazenly asked for his inheritance while his father was still alive, a rebellious and selfish thing to do. The father complied, and the young man left home and squandered all his money in wild living. A severe famine came, and the young man, now broke, ended up feeding pigs in order to support himself. He'd hit rock bottom. Destitute and starving, the young man finally decided to return home, hoping for forgiveness from his father, but expecting anger. To his surprise, his father welcomed him home with open arms, saying that his son had been dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. See Luke 15:11-32. In an early phone call to check on Adam's progress, Janice and Larry spoke with the program's director and Adam's counselor, Wayne Gray, who said that Adam is really embracing a relationship with Jesus Christ. Because of that, I believe Adam will find true meaning and purpose. He's learning that God loves him and God will guide him through this dark time. Adam began to earn a reputation among the staff and his peers for his enthusiasm, empathy, and, while he could be lighthearted and goofy, competitive nature and drive, which really shone on the basketball court. Most Sundays, when Adam traveled with Teen Challenge's small choir, singing at churches across central and northern Florida, he would volunteer to give his personal testimony. "How his drug addiction had impacted his family," says Gray. "He cried every time he told of driving away in the back seat of a police car, while he watched his mother crying so hard that his father had to hold her up. He always volunteered for our community street outreaches. We owned a 50-by-80-foot tent and would put it up in housing projects and parks to witness, do kids' programs, and serve meals. In short order, Adam was in charge of the tent crew. I'd watch him bark orders to make sure things were done safe, and then he'd play with the inner-city kids for hours." Says Kenny, "During outreach, Adam really connected with the kids, and he'd use that to impart some wisdom. Stay on the basketball court, stay off the drugs, that kind of thing." 2 weeks into Teen Challenge, Adam sent his parents a letter, which they put on their refrigerator door to read and reread in the months that followed. "Dear Mom and Dad, we're having quiet time at 9:30. I don't think we have to go to work tomorrow. Everyone is going on pass or something. I think every third Saturday in a month we're up for an 8-hour pass. A man graduated tonight. It was a wonderful thing. He spoke for a while, then his mom got up and asked to say something. She said, 'I am so proud of you.' I got chills that ran all through my body and a tear fell down my cheek. I wiped it away and realized the day that happens to me will be absolutely the greatest day I ever had. I know it is sad that graduating from a drug rehab is your greatest goal, but it is more than that. It is the first day I will be able to look at you with no shame. It is a new chance at life. It is a new beginning for all my family and friends. It is a day I will be totally living for Christ and not ashamed and thankful. I don't want to hear you say one time you are proud of me until that day, because that day I will be able to respect it. Praise God. Dad, you remember how you always just wanted me to finish one thing I started? Well, here it is. Not because I can do it, but because God is going to do it for me. For you, Dad. You, Mom, and for everyone that ever believed in me. Read Luke 15:11, Parable of the Lost Son. That is how I will come to you, and I know that is how y'all will rejoice. Only 352 days to go. Lights out, and God bless you. I'm doing fine. Love, Adam." In August 1997, after nearly 11 months in the program, Adam was granted a special leave, a 2-day visit home to attend Manda's wedding to Jeremy Atkinson, whom she had begun dating in college. At the ceremony, Adam and Sean escorted Janice into the church and seated her. Then together they lit the candles. At the reception, Janice was impressed by Adam's poise when he graciously deflected any focus that came his way from relatives and friends aware of his recovery and sobriety. "Thank you, but this is Manda's time," Adam would say. "We'll talk about it later." All had been forgiven in the Brown family. "The past is the past," Larry had told both Sean and Manda. Sean agreed, but was still wary and cordial at best when he was one-on-one with his brother. On the last Saturday in September, Adam celebrated a year of sobriety by returning to Hot Springs for good. The next morning, he stood before his parents and the congregation at Second Baptist Church. Although he had been sharing his testimony publicly for months back in Florida, he was especially nervous to thank the people who had been praying for him since his parents began attending the church. "I don't think I've ever had such beads of sweat rolling off me before I tell this story to people I know have loved me and prayed for me and been such a determining factor in changing my life," he began. Adam then told how he got off track in life and ultimately became an addict. "You never know what hopelessness means until you get there. And I got there," he said through tears. He talked about how he ended up stealing from his parents, others in his family, and friends so he could buy drugs. Finally, he reached rock bottom with his arrest for 11 felonies.
I got on my knees in jail, and I accepted Jesus Christ back into my heart, and God has changed my life. It was a little over a year ago that I accepted the Lord back into my life. I went to a program called Teen Challenge, a safe haven away from the world where you can learn the Word of God and how much God loves you and how God will never leave you or forsake you. I have true confidence now, not in me, but in the one who lives in me. Amen, said the congregation. My paths are straight now in Jesus Christ. I just praise God and thank you all so much for your prayer. There is a purpose for it all, and I just try and encourage you to remember this, and all of you who prayed for me. What you have done for me was not idle. It changed my life.
Chapter 7 Kelly. While Adam spiraled toward drug addiction in Hot Springs, a young woman a year and a half younger named Kelly Tippy was living a life somewhat paralleling his, though not as dark or wild. Born in Georgia and raised in Little Rock, Kelly was an A and B student through high school, a cheerleader who was active in her church, barely drank, and never smoked. She attended the University of Central Arkansas in Conway, but dropped out after one semester because she lacked direction, she says. She moved to an apartment back in Little Rock where her life revolved around work and partying, which continued heavily when she and some girlfriends road tripped to Panama City Beach, Florida, for spring break.
You know what? One of her friends said after a week. Wouldn't it be great to move here for the summer? Really have some fun?
That's just what Kelly did right after school let out, renting an apartment, finding a waitressing job, and diving into a carefree lifestyle that almost always called for a miniskirt or a bikini. She would wait tables in the evening, dance and party the rest of the night away, sleep until afternoon if she slept at all, hang out at the beach, and repeat the process 7 days a week. It was so much fun she didn't want the summer to end. Occasionally she felt a twinge of guilt for not returning to college, but for the most part she was content in the now, with nothing on the horizon but good times. The thought of home was particularly dreary. Though Kelly's childhood had been wonderful, everything had changed at age 13 when her parents began fighting. Kelly's mother would leave for days and even weeks at a time, and her father would shoulder the responsibility of raising Kelly and her younger brother. Arguments were nearly constant whenever Kelly's mother returned, and Kelly was no longer relaxed in her own home. Family had become a source of anxiety, not comfort. One Sunday, well into September, Kelly woke up in the middle of the day, looked around the dirty apartment her father was helping her rent in Panama City Beach, piles of laundry on the floor and party flyers taped to a fridge holding more alcohol than food, and thought,
"This isn't normal. This isn't right. I'm going nowhere." I felt pathetic, she says.
The next week, she was out with friends when a fight broke out and a male friend was badly beaten. That jolted her.
I don't hang around people like this, she thought. Where am I? What am I doing here?
Only days later, another friend,
Barry GQ, Mr. Mussy, flashy, super cocky type,
was shot during a drug deal gone bad. Kelly visited him in the hospital, and he was
so scared and humbled, she says, I could almost see the innocent boy he used to be before he got all wrapped up in this seedy world.
Late for work, Kelly hurried home to her apartment to change. As she fumbled through her closet for a pair of matching shoes amidst the disarray, she happened upon her Bible, the one book she'd brought with her from home. She picked it up, brushed off the sand and dust, sat on the bed with it on her lap, and said out loud,
Lord, it's time for me to get out of here, isn't it?
Hurricane Opal slammed into the Florida coast on October 4, 1995, with 100-mile-an-hour wind gusts and a massive storm surge. That morning, Kelly packed up her belongings and joined the evacuating throngs heading west through torrential rain and howling wind on gridlocked highways. She didn't stop driving until she'd reached Little Rock 15 hours later. After moving back in with her father, Kelly mended her relationship with her mother over long talks and reconnected with her spirituality. She began attending Otter Creek Assembly of God. She read her Bible. She searched for direction.
God, she prayed, what is my path?
Kelly took a job as a travel agent in early 1996 and enrolled in college courses at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, but she didn't finish her classes. Her heart just wasn't in it. Occasionally, she'd go out clubbing with friends but drank little, always volunteered to be the designated driver, and never again watched the sun come up after partying all night. On October 17, 1997, 2 years after Kelly returned home, she and her friend Stephanie headed to the hippest night spot in Little Rock to meet up with Heath Vance, whom Stephanie had gone to college with. Inside the smoky building, where an act reminiscent of the Rocky Horror Picture Show was being performed on the stage, Kelly and Stephanie located Heath Vance standing with several buddies. Kelly was instantly enamored with one of Heath's friends, a young man he introduced as Adam. Leaning toward Kelly, Stephanie quietly said,
"You can have any of them you want, but stay away from that one. He's crazy. Stay away from him."
"Ooh," said Kelly, "but he's the one I like."
"Don't say I didn't warn you," Stephanie said. "He's trouble."
Adam chose that moment to take his shirt off and begin whirling it over his head, hooting at the transvestite act on stage.
"Who is this guy?"
wondered Kelly.
"He's hilarious."
She kept staring at his crooked smile and deep blue eyes, smitten. What she didn't know was that Adam had been home from Teen Challenge for only 3 weeks. He had been clean and sober for just over a year. "I still question the wisdom," says Heath. "What in the world compelled me to bring Adam to a bar in Little Rock a couple of weeks out of drug rehab?" Likewise, Adam couldn't take his eyes off Kelly, a tall brunette with a girl-next-door face. Eventually, he walked over and stood near her.
"Y'all having a good time?" she asked him.
"Sure am," said Adam. "I don't get out much."
Kelly laughed.
"Yeah, right," she thought.
They talked for a while. Then out of the blue, Adam said,
"You smell so good, Kelly. What kind of perfume are you wearing?"
Overhearing the question, Stephanie rolled her eyes at what sounded like an obvious pickup line. But Kelly replied,
"That's funny. I have on three types of perfume tonight."
"Yeah? What are they?"
"Heaven, pleasures, and forever."
Without missing a beat, Adam said,
"That is funny. That's exactly how I picture us. Heaven, pleasures, and forever."
Adam went home that night with Kelly's number. The phone rang the following afternoon at Kelly's home.
"Hello," said Adam. "May I speak with Kelly, please?"
"This is Kelly."
"I thought so. Hey, this is Adam. Adam Brown. We met last night. What are you doing?"
"Oh, I just got home."
"Ah. Where you been?"
Kelly wanted to be honest and say that she'd just returned from teaching Sunday school, but she was nervous. She'd met this guy at a place that was, well, not where you'd expect a God-fearing Southern Baptist Sunday school teacher to be hanging out, and giving out her phone number, no less.
"Well, Adam, I just got home from church."
There was quiet, then a gigantic sigh of relief.
"I am so glad to hear you say that," Adam said. "I'm a Christian, and I go to church, too. And that's super important to my life. Figured I'd get that out in the open right off the bat."
Kelly had been on a handful of dates with Adam and never experienced an awkward moment of silence or boredom. He was quirky, funny, and silly, but at the same time a perfect gentleman who saw to her every need, from opening the car door to making sure her popcorn had enough salt at the movies. She went to church with him, too, and met Janice and Larry. Then one night they were to meet for dinner at the Waffle House in Benton, and Adam didn't appear. He finally showed up 40 minutes late, apologized as he grabbed a menu, and wouldn't meet her eye. It took Kelly only a minute to clue in.
"Are you on something?" she asked.
Funny story about that, he said, looking up at her with disappointed eyes. I actually am. While Kelly made him eat waffles and drink coffee, Adam explained how he had finished a drug treatment program only 2 months earlier. This is the first time I've done it in over a year. I drove through this part of town on the way here, and I parked in front of this house I used to go to. I got tempted and couldn't fight it. I went in, smoked some, and now I feel horrible. It will not happen again. He was talking so fast and so oddly that Kelly became worried. Not for her safety, but for his. He was acting weird. Crazy weird, she remembers. Just what Stephanie had warned her about. When his behavior hadn't changed after 2 hours, she made a decision.
You aren't going home like this, she said, then drove them to a nearby hotel.
I'm so sorry, he said at least a dozen times. In the room, he wrote a check to cover its cost, but she wouldn't accept it, so he shoved it in her purse. Kelly kept Adam talking into early morning, telling him about her parents fighting and their recent divorce, and Panama City and how she'd come home and made amends with her mother and thanked her dad for being there for her. Adam choked up when he told her about his own mother and father, how much they loved each other and everything they had done for him, how awesome his older brother was and what a great friend and supporter his twin sister had always been. He broke down and cried as he admitted he'd already let his family down, and now he was doing it again.
This isn't you, Kelly said. It's the drug. You have so much more to offer than this, Adam Brown. You know what? I'm going to pray for you.
That sounds like I won't be seeing you again, he said. After hugging him for a long time, she wiped his tears and said,
You just have to fight this.
At 4 in the morning, she drove them back to the Waffle House, fed Adam breakfast, and dropped him off at home. As she backed out of the driveway, he ran up beside the car and she rolled down the window.
I love you, he said. You know, it's funny, but I love you too.
She said, all the while thinking,
What in the world are you doing, Kelly Tippy?
She prayed for guidance as well as for Adam. But she knew her heart belonged to him, and nothing told her to run from the situation. The moment she'd laid eyes on him, she had fallen in love. It simply didn't matter that he came with baggage. Major baggage. When Kelly got home, she retrieved Adam's check from her purse and laughed because it was made out in pencil. Then she sighed heavily as she read the memo line, where Adam had written, I'm very sorry I disappointed you. For the next few weeks, Adam was on time for every date, which included taking Kelly's dog, a chocolate lab named Sydney, to swim at the lake, attending church, and holding hands on long walks. Says Kelly,
He'd just do sweet little things.
Like adjusting her car's air vents so the heat would blow on her when it was cold.
But the sweetest was how he'd make me feel important. He'd stare at me and I'd catch him. And he'd smile and tell me I was beautiful. He'd tell me over and over again how lucky he was.
One day she arrived at work to find a rose on her desk with a note. I love you, and I'm always thanking God for placing an angel in my heart. Adam. On another day, a gigantic box of a dozen jungle roses arrived, overnighted from the Amazon. When Kelly chastised Adam for spending that kind of money, he told her, You deserve the best. Then, in early December, Adam stood Kelly up.
It was the second time he'd relapsed, she says, and I was thinking, but wait, you're so sweet and perfect. Why? It's like two personalities.
Adam resurfaced 2 days later, as remorseful and apologetic as before. A moment of weakness, he explained. Like he'd done with Ryan Whited nearly 2 years earlier, he drove Kelly by the crack houses where she could look for him if he disappeared again.
But it's not going to happen again, she said to him.
A statement, not a question. He nodded. His head hung low. It did happen again. The week before Christmas. and Kelly found him in one of the drug houses. He was
dirty, disheveled, and gross, she says. He smelled.
And I told him, you have so much more to offer than this, and you know it. You are so much better than this. The third time it happened,
it was as if he was cheating on me, she explains. It almost felt like a girl. I'm getting jealous over this drug because it's taking my place, she told him.
I'm sorry, Adam pleaded with her. I don't want to do it. I really don't. It calls my name. I just start driving and then I'm there and it's too late. The fourth time, Kelly was beside herself.
How can I do this? She cried to Adam. How can I stay with you?
Please don't, he said. Really. I'm only going to bring you down. At the beginning of 1998, Kelly informed Janice and Larry of the relapses, and they told her to break up with Adam. He's lost, and you don't need that in your life. We're going to keep praying for a miracle, but we just don't know what's going to happen with Adam. We don't want him to drag you down with him.
But I love him, Kelly said.
The three of them put their heads together and decided to encourage Adam to return to Teen Challenge for the 6-month voluntary cap to the year-long program, a segment that helps individuals assimilate back into society. They had an intervention dinner with Adam, and he agreed he needed the help. I don't want to lose you, he told Kelly while he packed. He left for Teen Challenge that week.
I will be here waiting for you when you're done, Kelly assured him. 6 months is nothing.
Adam stayed in Florida less than a month. I've done my stint, he said to Kelly when they reunited. I know what I'm doing is wrong. Teen Challenge is a very secure place. It's a safe haven. You work, there's structure, you learn the Bible. You have no freedom. It's a safe environment, and then you get thrown back into reality. Okay, I've been guarded and protected in all this, and now I'm just back where I started. Even though I have all this knowledge and this wisdom I've gained from God and from my experience there, those demons are still calling my name. It takes over. So how do I live here in the real world?
Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding,
Kelly replied, quoting Proverbs 3:5-6.
In all your ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct your paths. You just have to trust in God and don't give in, she said.
For 6 months, Kelly spent the better part of her days either babysitting Adam or searching for him during his relapses, which occurred every week or two. Since being in Hot Springs seemed a big part of the problem, Adam moved 50 miles east to Little Rock, got his own apartment not far from Kelly and her father, enrolled in classes at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, and found work as a waiter at the Steak and Ale. Kelly handled his money, requiring receipts for every dime he spent. But it was easy for Adam to squirrel away tips for the next time he heard the drug call his name. On July 11th, 1998, Kelly and Adam attended Richard Williams' wedding in Arkadelphia, an hour south of Hot Springs. Adam was a groomsman, along with Jeff Bushman, Heath Vance, and other friends from high school. So the reception resembled a Lake Hamilton High class reunion. Richard had earned a bachelor's degree and an MBA. Jeff had gotten his bachelor's, had graduated from the Navy Officer Candidate School, and was currently attending Navy Flight School in Texas. There were more stories of college degrees and good jobs. Everybody had moved on to the next level, says Jeff. But Adam was at the same place he was when he graduated high school, and I could tell it bothered him. People who didn't know asked him what he'd been up to, and he'd say, "Still working with my dad, off and on." Throughout the festivities, Kelly stayed by Adam's side, making sure he didn't drink anything besides the champagne toast. They both knew what that would lead to. While Adam seemed saddened by the reminiscing, Kelly loved hearing about his crazy stunts, the belly flops, the bridge jump.
but she was deeply touched by the story of his refusing to take the life jacket off at the lake because his mother had told him not to.
He was so honest and so pure, Kelly thought.
At one point during the night, Richard took Kelly aside. "I'm sure you're hearing all these crazy stories about Adam," he said, "but let me tell you, the one thing you're probably not hearing is how he would jump in front of a truck for any one of us. He's got a heart of gold." With so many others advising Kelly to run from Adam, it was nice to hear something positive.
"Thank you, Richard," she said. "I can't tell you how much that means to me."
2 days after the wedding, Adam disappeared. The day after that, Larry called Kelly because one of his work trucks and a bunch of tools were missing.
"It's Adam," she said before he could finish. "I'll go find him."
"No, Kelly," Larry said. "You've done this how many times? I don't want you to go off and get yourself killed on account of Adam. I think the only thing that's going to stop him is prison."
"I'm sorry, Mr. Brown," she said firmly, "but Adam's not going to get off that easy."
9 months of patience, encouragement, and empathy had finally left Kelly feeling crazy angry. She hung up the phone before Larry could say another word. As she hurriedly got ready, she rehearsed aloud what she was going to tell her boyfriend when she tracked him down.
"I am sick and tired of this, Adam Brown. You are not going to do this to me. You are not going to do this to your family. I don't care if you're in trouble with some dealer. I don't care what your problem is. You are not going to go hawk all your dad's stuff. It's not fair."
Finished with her planned tirade, Kelly regained her composure and drove to the east side of Hot Springs to comb the streets. After 2 hours of fruitless searching, near dusk she was amazed to see Larry's truck, with Adam driving and someone in the passenger seat, pull out from a side street directly in front of her. She stopped beside him at a traffic light, and when Adam looked over and saw her, he hit the accelerator and sped through the red light. Kelly glanced left and right and did the same thing, staying on him as best she could. She pulled over briefly to wait for traffic to clear after Adam wildly swerved across two oncoming lanes to turn down a street. Then she continued the chase. On a long straightaway, Adam pulled over onto the shoulder, hit the brakes in a cloud of dust, jumped from the truck, and dashed into the woods. Parking behind, Kelly got out and approached the middle-aged man,
a sleazy drug addict,
sitting in the passenger seat. She leaned in through the open driver's door and grabbed the keys, then called the Browns on her cell phone, gave Larry the street name, and confirmed that he had his own set of keys. Ending the call, she told the addict to get out.
"Where did he go?"
she demanded. "Hell, lady, I don't know," the man snapped. He stepped out of the truck.
"Where did he go?" Kelly repeated. "I know you know."
The man stood there, shaking his head. "Well, I can take you to where we were going."
"Fine, hop in my car."
He directed her to a neighborhood not far away, where she parked in front of a run-down house. "You want me to go in, see if he's there?" the man asked.
"Yes," said Kelly. "Bring him out if he is."
She locked the doors after he left and waited for a few minutes. But feeling increasingly uncomfortable, she called the Browns to let them know she was okay and drove back to Little Rock. At home, she kicked off her shoes and fell into bed, exhausted. Staring at the ceiling, she prayed for Adam's safety. She always did on nights like this. This time, however, knowing she was at the end of her patience, she also asked for a favor.
"Lord," she prayed, "if you have something in mind for Adam, maybe you could nudge him a little, because he's having a real hard time finding that path on his own."
Jeff received a phone call at his apartment in Corpus Christi, Texas, the following morning. "Bush," said Adam, "I'm in trouble again and could really use your help. Can you get me a ticket to come down there? I promise I'll pay you back." Without further thought, Jeff bought Adam a one-way ticket from Little Rock and picked him up that evening at the airport. Over dinner, Adam filled him in on everything that had happened since the wedding. How he had done something so stupid that Kelly could have been raped or killed. From where Adam was hiding in the woods,
He'd watched her leave with the addict in her car. He'd hoofed it to the crack house where he'd been headed, searching for her car, but she'd already driven away. Then he walked to a nearby church and spent the night on the front steps praying. As much as he loved Kelly, Adam had concluded that he could not continue to endanger her life. The only way to protect her was to disappear, go somewhere far away, like to his buddy's place in Texas.
"I owe you," Adam told Jeff. "I had to get out of there, but you gotta promise me, if my parents or Kelly call, you can't tell them I'm here."
About the same time Adam's plane landed in Corpus Christi, a woman who worked at the Steak and Ale phoned Kelly with the news that she'd given Adam a ride to the airport, but she didn't know where he was headed, and he had no luggage with him.
"I just thought you should know," she said to Kelly. "He didn't look so good."
All of Adam's friends were within driving or hitchhiking distance of Hot Springs. Everyone except Jeff, whom Kelly called as soon as she got off work. Jeff had just promised to keep Adam's whereabouts under wraps when the phone rang. Pointing at the receiver, he mouthed to Adam, "Kelly." Adam shook his head adamantly, mouthing back,
"I'm not here."
"You bastard," Jeff thought. "You're going to make me lie to her, aren't you?" "Hi, Kelly," he said. "How are things? How's Adam?"
"Jeff, you are such a bad liar," Kelly said, laughing. "I know he's there. He got on a plane and flew there this morning. I checked the flight. Let me talk to him."
"Okay," he said, handing the phone to Adam, who cursed at his friend.
"She knows you're here," Jeff whispered. "She checked the flights. Dude, she's a travel agent."
But Adam refused to talk to her, so Kelly told Jeff she'd try again in a couple of days.
"I'm glad he's safe," she said. "I'll let his parents know he's with you."
When Jeff returned home from flight school around 10 the following night, he heard loud music in the apartment. His neighbors were young families, professionals, and officers in the military. And there was Adam on the second floor balcony, music blaring and a can of beer in his hand. "Bush!" he shouted. Infuriated, Jeff rushed into his apartment. He pushed aside the cold beer Adam offered, shut off the stereo, closed the door to the balcony, and said, "Adam, this isn't going to cut it, man. You cannot be doing this."
"Bush," Adam said, "I don't know what else to do. I sat here all day thinking maybe I'll go work on an oil rig, make some money, pay my parents back, the Whiteds, you know. But what then? I can't go back and work for my dad. I don't want to either. I don't want to go back to Teen Challenge. I'm praying every single day, but it's not getting any easier. I'm a loser."
"You're not a loser," Jeff replied, sitting across from Adam at the kitchen table. He had a sudden thought. "What about enlisting in the Navy?"
"With my record,
my dad could probably help with that and find out if it's even possible." Jeff knew the Navy. He'd spent a lifetime listening to his father talk about what it had to offer, and he knew Adam, so he considered the possible jobs that might fit Adam's personality. Something elite, but not out of reach. Says Jeff, "Most people didn't think of Adam as smart because he was always acting like a dumbass, but he was super intelligent, a thinker. Also fearless and a little crazy." "You could be an EOD guy," he told Adam. "Explosive ordnance disposal. You know, disarm bombs and blow things up."
"That'd be fun," said Adam, nodding. "But how about a SEAL? Your dad always said they're the best."
"I don't know, Adam. They are the best, but man, their training is tough. Real tough. And they do most of their training in the water. You have to be a good swimmer and diver."
"I can swim."
"You can keep yourself from sinking," said Jeff, to which Adam laughed. "But it's not just the training. You have to be a really good swimmer. And I'm not talking Lake Hamilton. I'm talking about the ocean." If Adam did qualify for general enlistment, he'd be 4 or 5 years older than most of the other recruits in boot camp. It would be tough to keep up with the guys fresh out of high school. The boot camp standouts would get the good positions, and Jeff didn't want Adam to end up a fleet sailor assigned to a ship on tours lasting 9 months and sometimes more than a year. So he kept pushing Adam toward EOD. It wasn't popular, for obvious reasons, but it was elite and important. By the end of the discussion, Jeff saw some of the spark return to the eyes of his old buddy, who shook his hand and thanked him. The next day, Adam called Kelly to apologize. He told her that he'd run from the woods and tried to chase her car down when she'd driven off with the addict. "I knew nothing about that guy," he said. "He could have been a serial killer. You could have been killed, and it would have been all my fault. I'm not good for you. That's why I left. I don't want you to keep chasing after me."
"Do you really want me to stop?" Kelly asked. "In your heart?"
"No," said Adam. "In my heart, I love you. But that's why I need to let you go." Kelly told Adam how she'd been praying, and praying hard, asking God for guidance, asking him directly if she should abandon the relationship.
"Adam," she said, "God has not told me to leave you. I love you. My heart says stay and see this through."
"You are stubborn." "How can I argue against that?" She laughed, then warned him that she wouldn't be stubborn forever. It was time for him to make a plan, a real plan that he would stick to. Adam said that Jeff was encouraging him to join the Navy and aim for EOD. "But ever since I saw that movie Navy SEALs in high school, I've wanted to be a SEAL. Do you think I can do it?"
"Of course you can," Kelly said without hesitation,
even though she had only the most basic idea of what a Navy SEAL did. There was a long silence before Adam spoke again.
"This is what I need to do," he said. "I can feel it in my heart. I need to get out of Hot Springs. But the only way I'm going to do it is if you marry me. I want you with me. Will you marry me, Kelly?"
So many times she had prayed about whether she should leave Adam or stay, and
"God never told me to leave. Not once."
Still, it was a leap of faith when she said,
"Okay, Adam, I'll marry you. But there are going to be some rules."
The following day, July 19, 1998, Adam returned home to Hot Springs and married Kelly in front of a justice of the peace. They didn't tell a soul, nor did they celebrate with a special dinner or even a date. While she loved Adam dearly, this marriage was almost a business arrangement.
"He knew I was committed," Kelly says. "Now he had to prove he was committed. I had to play it tough and couldn't let my guard down yet."
The day after, Kelly went to work and Adam called Ryan Whited, who was now married and living in Hot Springs. Adam shared his plan to join the Navy.
"If this is what you feel like you need to do, I'm behind you 100%, Ryan replied. "But you need to make real sure, because a military prison is going to be awful, and that's what's going to happen if you slip up."
"I'm certain," Adam said. Ryan agreed to take him to the local recruiting office, and on the drive there, Adam said that he planned to be completely honest.
"Well, you might not want to volunteer that you smoke crack," Ryan replied. "If you do, I can promise you that you're not getting into the military. Just wait and see what they ask."
"If I can't be honest, then maybe it's not what God has planned for me," said Adam. Inside the Spartan office were two large framed photographs, President Clinton and a highly decorated naval officer.
"Check it out," Adam whispered to Ryan. "There's Mr. Bushman."
"Hey, guys, what's going on?" asked the recruiter. "Hello, sir," Adam said. "I'd like to join the Navy. I want to be a SEAL."
"Great. Have a seat." While they talked, Ryan listened in and paced around the office, examining the posters of aircraft carriers, battleships, and the camouflage-painted face of a SEAL rising out of dark waters. Adam filled out forms, and the recruiter explained that some standard questions would need to be answered and that Adam would be fingerprinted and have to sign under oath. Lying under oath was subject to a fine and possible imprisonment. So traffic tickets, stuff like that, are okay. But if you've ever been arrested or anything like that, tell us up front.
Yes, sir, I have.
The recruiter nodded and said, okay, for what?
I had 11 felonies, mostly stealing, nothing violent. But I don't think you'll find them on my record because I went to a drug treatment program after jail.
Are you clean now?
Well, sir, I'm not sure how long it stays in your system, but I have smoked crack. But I'm done with that. It's not going to happen again.
The recruiter leaned in on the table and shook his head.
Adam, I really appreciate your honesty, he said.
I do. But do you really think you can join the Navy? This isn't a joke.
Adam pointed to the photograph of Captain Roger Bushman, Commodore of U.S. Navy Recruiting Command Area 3, the highest-ranking officer in all the Navy recruiting districts in the southeastern United States, and the boss of this recruiter's boss.
Call and ask him.
You're serious? The recruiter said.
I'm serious. Maybe he can help.
Give him a call. He'll at least vouch for me.
In his office in Macon, Georgia, Captain Bushman received a call from the recruiter in Hot Springs.
Sir, he said, I'm really sorry to bother you, but do you know a young man by the name of Adam Brown?
I sure do, said Captain Bushman.
He wants to join the Navy. He says he wants to be a SEAL, but he's...
Well, sir, are you aware he's got a record a mile long?
He's had some drug issues and just a lot of issues. I was going to send him out the door, but then he asked me to call you.
A wave of positive memories washed over Captain Bushman. Adam Brown was the boy he'd considered most likely to succeed. The boy who had always followed the rules, even when it wasn't cool, even when nobody was looking. Months earlier, Jeff had filled him in on Adam's problems, so he knew about the drugs. He wasn't aware, however, of Adam's arrest, or the laundry list of offenses the recruiter read to him. He couldn't fathom any of it, because it was so out of character for the Adam he knew. And if there was one thing Captain Bushman had an eye for, it was character.
I'll vouch for him, he said.
Sir?
Use whatever waivers he needs, Captain Bushman confirmed. Treat him like he's my own son.
After Adam signed the required stack of waivers, it was official. He was a Navy recruit. The newlyweds took Ryan and his wife up on their offer to stay with them until boot camp began in 3 weeks, then decided that they should start their life together properly by getting married in a church, God's house. They discussed whether to invite their parents, but Kelly was certain her dad would not be pleased, and Adam thought his parents would conclude that he and Kelly had acted rashly and try to talk them out of it.
We'll just have to prove to them that it was the right thing to do, said Kelly.
They explained their situation to Ryan, who introduced them to his pastor, and that Sunday, July 26th, he called them to the front of his church. Before the congregation, Adam and Kelly said their vows and were married for a second time. The pastor then asked his congregation to bow their heads.
God, he said, we pray for a miracle in the lives of this young couple.
Adam called home the next day.
Dad, he said, I have some things I need to tell you and Mom.
Okay, said Larry.
I'm ready.
Kelly and I got married.
Well, your mom and I love Kelly, and we would like to have been there, but that's okay.
There's something else.
I joined the Navy.
Chapter 8 Rising Up.
Those 3 weeks before he left for boot camp, there was something different about Adam I hadn't seen before, says Kelly. There was an intensity. A focus.
In the evenings while she watched television or read, Adam was on the living room floor cranking out push-ups and sit-ups. During the day, every overhanging tree branch and playground monkey bar he passed gave the opportunity for as many pull-ups and chin-ups as his arms could muster. When Kelly went to work at the travel agency, Adam swam laps at the YMCA or drove to Wolf Stadium 6 years after graduating from Lake Hamilton High, and jogged the track and ran the bleachers.
I could smell the crack sweating out of me, he told SEAL buddy Kevin Houston years later. I ran those steps, just like in high school, singing Eye of the Tiger in my head. Rising up, back on the street, did my time, took my chances. I love that song. One morning, Adam parked his truck on the eastern side of the 70 West Bridge and walked down the trail to the shore. He waded into Lake Hamilton, swam the quarter mile to the western shore, hoofed it up one of the trails he'd used as a kid, and tried to run back to the truck he'd borrowed from Larry. By the time he got there, he was stumbling and nearly collapsed. Angry at his weakness, Adam returned the next morning to do it again. The second week of August, 1998, Adam reported to the Naval Training Center in Great Lakes, Illinois, more than 1,000 miles from the nearest ocean. Jeff Bushman had called him right before he left for the airport to wish him luck. And hey, he'd said, if you think you're going to screw this up, go AWOL to smoke some dope or something. Don't do it, because my dad really put his ass on the line for you. The following day, 24-year-old seaman recruit Brown lined up with 100-some 18- and 19-year-olds in his division to get his hair buzzed off, his uniforms issued, and his bunk assigned. Then he had 2 minutes to use the phone, long enough for him to call Kelly and sing out, "Hey, baby, I'm in the Navy now. I'll call you again in 3 weeks." Back in Little Rock, where she had moved in with her father, the new Mrs. Brown was a nervous wreck. She knew Adam had what it took to make it through boot camp, but she also knew the likelihood for a relapse. Every time the idea of failure weaseled its way into her mind, she prayed for Adam to have strength against his addiction. "That was the only thing that would stop him," she says. "I couldn't forget how Adam would tell me every time he messed up. It calls my name." It gave her hope that all he was allowed to bring with him to boot camp were the clothes on his back, his identification, and $5. Kelly had nixed the $5. With money in hand, an addict can find drugs anywhere. Over dinner with Janice and Larry one night, Kelly could sense their reservations, despite the optimism they conveyed. Exactly what she was experiencing.
"We didn't get our hopes up," says Janice, who had continued to pray that Adam was finding his path.
Sometimes the worry consumed her, and then she'd call her now close friend, Helen Webb.
"Don't you worry," Helen told her during one such call. "We are surrounding your Adam with the Holy Spirit. There's a hedge of protection around him. Those fiery darts of Satan won't penetrate."
Her words gave Janice chills. She could physically feel something like an electrical charge. Her faith was renewed. If Adam made it through boot camp, Kelly knew she would be moving to Great Lakes to be by his side on the long journey to become a Navy SEAL. Completing 8 weeks of boot camp was only the first hurdle. In addition to the normal duties of learning how to march, salute, fold your clothes, and make your bed the Navy way, recruits interested in becoming SEALs held a SEAL challenge contract, which gave them 3 opportunities to pass the SEAL physical screening test. PST, 500-yard swim using breaststroke or side stroke in no more than 12 minutes and 30 seconds, 10-minute rest period, 42 perfect push-ups in no more than 2 minutes, 2-minute rest period, 50 sit-ups in no more than 2 minutes, 2-minute rest period, at least 6 pull-ups from a dead hang position with no time limit, 10-minute rest period. 1.5-mile run in boots and long pants in 11 minutes and 30 seconds, or less. If Adam passed the SEAL PST and graduated from boot camp, his next hurdle would be A school to earn a naval rating. He had chosen fireman, interior communications, electrician, striker, ICFN. The career path recommended by the recruiter because of Adam's experience as an electrician, and that involved almost 6 months of intense classroom and field training at Great Lakes. He would have to graduate with satisfactory grades before heading to a 12-day BUDS, Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL, indoctrination course on Coronado Island, across the bay from San Diego, California.
This would determine who would attend what was arguably the toughest military school on the planet, the 173-day BUDS course. Only then would Adam be assigned to a SEAL team. But he wouldn't truly be a SEAL until 6 to 9 months later, when he had completed advanced SEAL training and earned his trident, the gold insignia pin only worn by fully trained SEALs. More than 2 years of training were required to become a qualified Navy SEAL. Getting to that goal required that Adam remain completely drug-free. The waivers he'd signed made it clear. One drug infraction, and he was gone. Out of the Navy, and perhaps into a military prison. Statistics were also against his chances of success. Only about 20% of candidates complete BUDS. Those who don't are assigned to a ship in the fleet. All this information made Kelly's head spin, but it also gave her focus. In the weeks Adam was away, she came to realize how much of her life, her emotional being, she was devoting to him. She herself had been somewhat lost before she'd met him, and Adam, baggage and all, gave her direction.
"An angel sent from heaven,"
was how Janice and Larry described their new daughter-in-law.
"There was no question," says Janice, "that she was going to stand by Adam's side no matter what."
When they prayed for Adam, they wanted him to succeed as much for Kelly as for himself, because they knew she was in it for the long haul. Currently, Kelly was in limbo, poised between her old life as Adam's girlfriend, cheerleader, babysitter, and her new life as a Navy wife, which Janice and Larry joked with her would be the same as before, but with more ironing. In Adam's fourth week of boot camp, Kelly received a letter with great news. He had passed the SEAL physical screening test. He didn't let on how well everything was really going. His year at Teen Challenge had prepared him for the seemingly endless string of rules and regulations, and what the Navy dished out physically wasn't much worse than the sweltering two-a-day summer football practices with the Lake Hamilton Wolves. At 24,